The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Good evening, everybody. Thank you for coming. My name is Andy Cahan. I'm the Director of Author Events here. Before we get started, please turn off your cell phones and plan to join us upstairs after tonight's presentation for a book signing. This evening's presentation is part of Independence Starts Here, a festival of disability arts and culture in the greater Philadelphia area, featuring contemporary and classic art that includes the work of professional and community artists with disabilities and features work that is inspired by the experience of disability. Please visit their website at independencestartshere.org for more info. Our sign language interpreter this evening is Yona Diamond Dansky. If you'd like to see her signing more clearly, please feel free to move forward. Tonight's guest, Marguerite Fox, is a journalist for the New York Times, where you may recall reading her heartfelt encomium to the author Grace Paley, who died this past August. Ms. Fox holds bachelor's and master's degrees in linguistics from Stony Brook University and a master's degree from the Columbia School of Journalism. Through her mentor at Stony Brook, the distinguished linguist Mark Aronoff, she first became aware of the remarkable signing village Es Sayid in the southern Israeli desert of Negev, where a remarkable sign language arose that is used by the deaf and hearing villagers alike. In her book, Talking Hands, Marguerite transports readers to an exotic place to illuminate a family of languages largely overlooked by science, while providing an extraordinary window into how human language works in the mind. Please welcome Marguerite Fox. I forgot to slow down.
Thank you all very much for coming. And special thanks tonight to the Festival of Disability Arts and Culture at the Free Library of Philadelphia for having me tonight. And again, my personal thanks to our interpreter tonight, Yona Diamond Dansky. Here's how the evening is going to be structured. I'm going to read a bit from Talking Hands. Then I'm going to talk for a few minutes about my journey from America to an isolated Bedouin village where deaf and hearing people alike use an indigenous sign language. Then I'll show a few more slides. Then I'll take questions from anyone in the audience. And then last but certainly not least, we're all going to go upstairs where you're going to mob me and have me sign lots and lots of copies. So here we go. Here is the opening passage of Talking Hands. The house is a lighted island in a sea of gathering dark. The sun has just gone down, and the desert breeze blowing in through the large open windows is cooler now. Outside, just beyond the house, fields of yellow stubble give way to a flat expanse of sand and scrub that stretches toward the distant hills ringing the horizon. A band of vermilion hangs above the hills, and above that, the sky is an inverted bowl of deep turquoise. Across the sand, a line of shadowy forms can be seen picking its way slowly toward the house, the village camels home for the night. From a nearby mosque, the muezzin's call to prayer floats through the open windows. The windows have deep marble sills, but no glass, for the house is barely half finished. Right now, it is little more than walls. sheer slabs of whitewashed concrete that seemed to rise organically from the surface of the desert. There is no front door yet, and no front steps. You enter perilously by clawing your way up a steep concrete ramp coated with blown sand. Inside, the house is hollow. Its half-dozen rooms have neither doors nor windows, and underfoot, where the floor will be, is only hard-packed dirt. Garlands of electrical wires sprout from the bare white walls. A black rubber hose of indeterminate purpose snakes across the ground from room to room. That is all there is to the house so far, but its raw state suits the desert. On this summer evening, the half-built house is alive with people. In the main room, which overlooks the hills, the owner of the house, a stocky man in an untucked plaid shirt, has set a long plastic banquet table on the earthen floor with a dozen plastic patio chairs around it. The table is filling with food. Children materialize with platters of nuts, sunflower seeds, and miniature fruit, tiny pears, nectarines, and plums. A tray of small china cups is set out, and a boy of about 12 enters, carrying a brass coffee pot, blackened from use, with a graceful spout curved like a pelican's beak. He pours the coffee, thick, black, sweet, and tasting of cardamom. At the other end of the table, a boy with a thermos pours strong, sweet tea into small glasses crammed with fresh mint. People start to take their seats. At the head of the table, the owner is joined by a group of men in their 30s and 40s. Down one side of the table is a row of boys in graduated sizes, from toddlers to teenagers. More children play on the floor nearby. Some very young ones, a few girls among them, peer shyly into the room from behind the door frame. At the foot of the table sits a knot of visitors. There are six of us, four scholars of linguistics, a video camera operator, and me. We have all traveled great distances, some of us crossing oceans, to be in this half-finished house tonight. The man and his family are Bedouins, and the house is at the edge of their village, Es Said. Though they live in the desert, the Bedouins of Es Said are not nomads. Their people have inhabited this village, tucked into an obscure corner of what is now Israel, miles from the nearest town, for nearly 200 years. There are no timeless figures from T.E. Lawrence here, wandering the sands in billowing robes. These Bedouins are rooted, even middle class. Men and boys are bareheaded and dressed in Western clothing, mostly T-shirts and jeans. Families live in houses, some with indoor plumbing and vast sofas upholstered in plush. They own automobiles, computers, and VCRs. But there is something even more remarkable about the Es Said Bedouins, and that is what has brought the team of scholars here this evening. A highly unusual language, spoken only in this village and never documented until now. The house is a babel tonight. Around the long table, six languages are in use at once, conversation spilling across conversation. There are snatches of English, mostly for my benefit. There is Hebrew. Two of the linguists are from an Israeli university, and many of the men of Asayid speak it as well. There is a great deal of Arabic, the language of the home for Bedouins throughout the Middle East. But in the illuminated room, it is the other languages that catch the eye. They are signed languages, the languages of the deaf. As night engulfs the surrounding desert and the cameraman's lights throw up huge signing shadows, it looks as though language itself has become animate as conversations play out in grand silhouette on the whitewashed walls. There are three signed languages going. There is American Sign Language, used by one of the visitors, a deaf linguist from California. There is Israeli Sign Language, the language of the deaf in that country, whose structure the two Israeli scholars have devoted years to analyzing. And there is a third language, the one the linguists have journeyed here to see, a signed language spoken in this village and nowhere else in the world. The language is Asayid's genetic legacy. In this isolated traditional community, where marriage to outsiders is rare, a form of inherited deafness has been passed down from one generation to the next for the last 70 years. Of the 3,500 residents of the village today, nearly 150 are deaf, an incidence 40 times that of the general population. As a result, an indigenous sign language has sprung up here, evolving among the deaf villagers as a means of communication. That can happen whenever deaf people come together. But what is so striking about the sign language of Asayid is that many hearing villagers can also speak it. It permeates every aspect of community life here, used between parents and children, husbands and wives, from sibling to sibling and neighbor to neighbor. At every hour of the day, in the houses, in the fields, and in the mosque, there are people conversing in sign. In Asayid, the four linguists have encountered a veritable island of the deaf. Their work here will occupy them for years to come, in all likelihood for the rest of their careers. They plan to observe the language, to record it, and to produce an illustrated dictionary, the first ever documentary record of the villagers' signed communication system. But the linguists are after something even larger. Because Asayid Bedouin Sign Language has arisen entirely on its own, outside the influence of any other language, it offers a living demonstration of the language instinct, man's inborn capacity to create language from thin air. If the linguists can decode this language, if they can isolate the formal elements that make Asayid Bedouin Sign Language a language, they will be in possession of a new and compelling body of evidence in the search for the ingredients essential to all language, signed and spoken. And in so doing, they will have helped to illuminate one of the most fundamental aspects of what it means to be human. Thank you. Now I'd like to talk for a few minutes about my journey to the signing village of Isayad. As Andy said, the journey came about through the great privilege of knowing the distinguished linguist Mark Aronoff. Here are the four linguists who were part of the research team working in the village. From the left, we have Carol Padden, Mark Aronoff, the project leader, Wendy Sandler, and Irit Meyer. Now, Mark Aronoff was my professor in both undergraduate and graduate school. I babysat for his oldest kids, and finally, in exchange for the many diapers that I changed over the years, he gave me the subject of my first book. It took 25 years. About 6 years ago, Mark was visiting me near my office in Times Square, and we were having lunch in a noisy restaurant. And over the din, I was lamenting about the fact that because of my linguistics training and my present work as a journalist, I really, really wanted to combine the two and write a book about language for a popular readership. But no suitable topic had come up. And full disclosure, I was not lamenting. I was whining. I was kvetching. And Mark said, out of the blue, "Well, why don't you come with us to the desert?" And I said, "Desert? What desert? Where?" And that was when they told me that they had been working in secret in this isolated Bedouin community in Israel. And so I wrote Talking Hands, first of all, as the narrative of their extraordinary scientific quest. These four scientists have the rare privilege of watching the language instinct in action. In the village of Isayad, they actually get the privilege of seeing what happens when the human mind gets to make a language from scratch. Now, to go over the numbers again, in Isayad, there are 3,500 residents. Of that 3,500, about 150 are deaf, about 4% of the population. Now, 4% may not sound like a very big number, but it's important to bear in mind that in the general population, in both Israel and the United States, the rate of deafness is 0.1%, 1 in 1,000. In this village, it's 1 in 25, 40 times greater. And the result, as can happen in such isolated villages, is an indigenous sign language has sprung up. It first sprang up 70 years ago when, three generations ago, the first deaf children in the village were born, about 10 of them in a single generation. And what is so exciting is the sign language is used by deaf and hearing people alike. Now, why should that be? Because in a traditional village like this, where everybody knows everybody and huge extended families live together, if you chose any hearing villager at random, the chances are overwhelming that that person would have a deaf parent, a deaf sibling, a deaf child, a deaf cousin, a deaf neighbor, a deaf friend. And sign language is completely interwoven into the domestic, social, occupational, and religious life of this community, deaf and hearing members alike. A typical village scene is this. You can see in this picture there are some bigger new houses going up like this, but most of the traditional houses are very small and simple. One story, a corrugated tin roof, inside maybe one or two rooms, and there will be in those one or two rooms an enormous extended family. Now remember, this is a Bedouin community, which means they have polygamy. So in this two-room house, the head of the house might have three wives, 20 children, maybe six or eight of the children will be deaf, and when you walk in the door, the entire extended family is talking away in a mixture of spoken Arabic and the village sign language. And then you look up and you see a camel shambling by the front door and you think, we are not in Kansas anymore. It's like no other place I have ever been. And I had the privilege of going with the researchers on a 3-day field trip to Esayed in the summer of 2003. And the narrative of that trip forms the narrative spine of Talking Hands. So I wrote the book, first of all, to talk about this extraordinary scientific mission, but I wrote it for another reason as well. And the reason is this. I wanted to talk in a general way about the sign languages of the world. Even educated hearing people, and I included myself among them before I began my research for this book, even educated hearing people are taught very, very little about sign language, what it is, and why it's important. And in fact, sign language is right now providing cognitive science with a whole new way of looking at how all human language, signed and spoken, works inside our heads. To give you an example of how little hearing people know about sign language, I will quote my editor at Simon & Schuster, the man who acquired this book. He is a senior vice president at Simon & Schuster, very bright, very well educated. I would even call him erudite. When he acquired the book and we had lunch, the first question he ever asked me was, "So, do all deaf people all over the world speak the same universal sign language or what?" And, of course, as many of you know, nothing could be farther from the truth. For instance, American Sign Language and British Sign Language, although they're both found in English-speaking countries, are pretty much mutually unintelligible. As it happens, a deaf American will have an easier time understanding a deaf Frenchman. Why? For historical reasons that have to do with the importation of teachers from the deaf from France to start the first permanent residential schools for the deaf in this country in the early 1800s. So ASL is actually historically descended in part from French Sign Language. Now, I want to read you a little bit from the book to answer my editor's question about, is there one sign language around the world? What I write is this. Scholars have documented more than 100 sign languages around the world. There are probably many others still unrecorded. nearly every country has its own national sign language. There is French Sign Language and British Sign Language, Spanish Sign Language and Italian Sign Language, German Sign Language, Swedish Sign Language, Danish Sign Language and Finnish Sign Language, Greek Sign Language, Turkish Sign Language, Hungarian Sign Language and Russian Sign Language, Israeli Sign Language and Saudi Arabian Sign Language, Chinese Sign Language, Taiwanese Sign Language, Hong Kong Sign Language, Thai Sign Language, Japanese Sign Language, Korean Sign Language, Australian Sign Language, New Zealand Sign Language, Indonesian Sign Language, Quebecois Sign Language, Mexican Sign Language, Chilean Sign Language, Brazilian Sign Language, Algerian Sign Language, Mozambican Sign Language, Zimbabwean Sign Language. You get the idea. And thank you, Yona. Masterfully done. So this was the other reason I wrote the book, just to get to write that paragraph and to torture interpreters. Now, the whole field of sign language study is really brand new in terms of the history of intellectual endeavor. And that's the other reason it's so exciting. As many of you know, it wasn't until 1960 that American Sign Language was determined to be a real language, thanks to the work of a wonderful professor at Gallaudet named William Stokoe. And it wasn't until about 10 years after that that the scientific community of linguists began to realize that sign language provided the most extraordinary window onto the mental machinery that underpins all human language, signed and spoken. Now, before that time, before the 60s and 70s, as many of you know, ASL was considered one of two things. At best, it was considered English on the hands, a word-to-word version of English that was simply delivered manually rather than orally. At worst, it was considered a crude pantomime with no grammar, no parts of speech, no way of expressing abstract or even vaguely sophisticated concepts. And through that attitude toward language, deaf people were marginalized and were denied a claim on their own language and their own culture for far too many years. Fortunately, in the 60s and 70s, that all began to change. We now know that ASL is not mime, nor is it English on the hands, but instead it's a full, rich language in its own right, with its own grammar and syntax, its own way, in other words, of putting words and sentences together that can be quite different from what we see in English, but is no less grammatical for that. Let me share the following examples with you. Every speaker of English knows that English loves compound words. Words that historically derive from the combination of two separate words, like blackboard, cupboard, greenhouse, porterhouse, etc. Well, American Sign Language has compounds too. And like English, it forms its compounds historically from two distinct signs that over time have coalesced into one smooth, unitary sign with its own meaning. But let's take a look at a few compounds in ASL. If you're a speaker of English, you're not going to recognize them. We have one compound that evolved from the combination of the verb think and the verb marry. And what does the compound sign think marry mean? It's the verb believe. Here's another one. The noun face and the adjective strong. What does the compound face strong mean? It means resemble. And my personal favorite, the adjective nude and the verb zoom off. And what does nude zoom off mean? Why, it's the noun streaker. And you know that entered the ASL lexicon in the 1970s. So in short, the discovery of the essential languageness of signed language is allowing scientists right now to see sign languages as a way of looking at how all human language, whether it's delivered orally, by mouth and ear, or by hand and eye, a way of seeing how it all operates psychologically and neurologically inside our heads. And I'll give you one last example about what scientists are learning of the neuroscience of sign language. It's really fascinating, and it's discussed in full in the book. In the 70s, once ASL was determined to be a real language, a tantalizing question arose. Now, scientists have known since the late 19th century that in most people, the left side of the brain controls language function, whereas the right hemisphere of the brain controls visual and spatial operations, things like rotating objects in space, copying diagrams, following a map. All the things I'm really bad at are controlled by the right brain. So once sign languages, these languages of moving hands in space, were discovered to be real languages, it raised a fascinating empirical question. Which hemisphere of the brain controls sign language function? Is it the left, because sign language is, after all, a language? Or is it the right, because sign languages depend essentially on moving hands in space? Equally compelling arguments could be made on both sides, and for a while there was no way to decide between the arguments. Then, in the late 1970s, researchers at the Salk Institute in California had a very bright idea. They conjectured that of the thousands of Americans who suffer strokes every year, surely some of them must be native deaf signers. So they scoured the country for deaf signing stroke patients, and they found an initial group of 6 people. And as luck would have it, 3 of those signers had had strokes that affected the left hemisphere. The other 3 had strokes that affected the right. Amazingly, despite the strong visual and spatial character of sign language, the patients who had suffered damage to the right hemisphere signed and understood sign language as well as they ever did before. Interestingly, though, they had trouble, in some cases great trouble, with non-language spatial tasks. They couldn't copy drawings. They couldn't find their way around buildings in which they'd lived all their lives, and so forth. Then, when the other group of signers was studied, these were the signers that had suffered damage to the left hemisphere, they displayed language pathology, that is, sign language aphasia, that was directly comparable to the language pathologies that hearing speakers can suffer when they have strokes on the left. These signers, depending on the location of the lesion, had great trouble producing comprehensible sign, Others had great trouble understanding signing that was signed to them. But they had no difficulty doing other spatial tasks. They copied drawings beautifully. They followed maps beautifully, and so on. So the tremendous lesson that was learned from this research is, despite its overwhelmingly visual character, sign is a language, and at some basic neurological level, the signer's brain knows it. And whether a language is what we call oral, or whether it's manual visual, language function is located overwhelmingly in the left hemisphere, because that is how men and women come hardwired into the world, deaf and hearing alike. So it was for all this, to talk about the extraordinary research that is right now putting the study of sign language at the center of cognitive science research, and also to talk about the journey to this extraordinary village where men and women sign, and children sign, deaf and hearing sign, to talk about all this that I chose to write Talking Hands. So let me show a couple of more slides, and then I'll be glad to take questions. The linguist you've seen. This is research in a Bedouin home. Notice shoes off, sitting on the floor. Notice the absence, complete absence of furniture, sitting on the floor in the traditional way, as Wendy Sandler, the team leader, is administering a series of tests. And what she's probably doing is showing signers a slideshow of everyday objects, cat, dog, knife, fork, to elicit the basic signed vocabulary of the Bedouin's indigenous language. Here's a session in another home. Here are Wendy and Irit working with a village woman. Out of respect for village traditions, you notice we do not show women's faces in the slides. Here is Carol Padden, the only deaf member of the team, working with a village child. And the boys and girls this age are now the third generation of village signers. The sign language is 70 years old, started with this boy's grandparents. Here's a village man signing. And although he is saying something meaningful in the village sign language, I must confess that to me, as an American Jew, it does look like he's going so new. Here he's saying, again, something meaningful. Here's a village man with his little daughter, attired in this gorgeous traditional dress. Here, in a lighter moment away from work, is Irit Meyer, one of the two Israeli linguists, learning to weave on a traditional Bedouin loom. And for those of you who have done any weaving, look at how the loom is only 3 or 4 inches off the floor. You have to kneel on the warp threads to do any weaving, which is very unusual compared to Western looms, where it's a big machine in front of you like a piano, and you sit in a chair to weave. And finally, everything you've heard about Arab home hospitality is true. You can't go into a house without being fed, in addition to wonderful coffee and tea, these enormous meals. And the linguists have learned the hard way to time their visits to Bedouin homes very carefully, because the women of the village will compete to see who can serve them the most elaborate meal. So if they're not careful in their timing their research visits, they will have to eat a meal this size twice within the course of about 3 hours. And that's the book. That's the village. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll be glad to take any questions.
Folks, if you put up your hands, we'll get a microphone to you. Those who are signing, we'll send Yona your way, and then she'll voice the question to the audience. Who would like to start us off? Right here in the third row.
Could you say a few words about the educational system in this village? Or is there one or two or a combination?
The question was about what is the education system in the village. The answer is complex. In short, this indigenous sign language may be endangered, and it relates to the education system in the following way. For a number of years now, the young deaf boys and girls of the village have been bused during the day to Israeli state-run schools for the deaf. And there, they are taught all day long in spoken language, which will be either spoken Hebrew or spoken Arabic, accompanied by the teacher signing along as she speaks in a pared-down version of Israeli sign language, what we might call signed Hebrew. Now, Israeli sign language is a totally different language from Essayid Bedouin sign language, and what the scientists are already noticing is when these deaf children come back home to the village at night, they carry the Israeli signs with them. And so in one more generation, when the older signers have died, this unique indigenous sign language, which is like no other sign language in the world, may be gone, or at least permanently altered. So the work of these scientists, besides being inherently fascinating, has this added layer of urgency, because there's just a short window of time during which this language is going to remain more or less untouched by any other language.
Another question? Third row here. Folks, you know what? We'll get the microphone back to you momentarily.
Thank you for this evening. In Essayid, is there a predominant religion?
Muslim, absolutely. And I did wonder a little bit about how I would be received as an American, a woman, and a Jew. And the answer is, no problem, because the only salient distinction is, are you an Essayid Bedouin? There are Essayid Bedouins, and then there's the entire rest of the world. And that's pretty much the operative binary cultural distinction they make. So I was in that entire rest of the world category, and it didn't faze them a bit at all, and they were absolutely lovely to us wherever we went.
Right here in the fourth row.
First, thank you. And I have a question and a comment. I'll start with a comment. I was really surprised to see both of the seated images of Wendy Steiner with her feet, with the soles of her feet, pointing at the local people, which is incredibly rude.
Is it?
It's terribly rude, any part of the Middle East. And you made a point of talking about respecting local custom and not showing the women's faces, but this is a huge no-no. So I want to comment that your hosts were very gracious and cut you a lot of slack. That's the first thing.
What is one supposed to do with one's feet?
Everybody else had their feet folded under them or their legs crossed. No soles toward the face.
That's interesting. I will have to ask
Wendy
about that.
My question, which is much more important than my slightly snarky comment, was is that in your first chapter, when you were reading it, you said that this sign language has existed for the three generations, absent any influence from any other language. And that, yes, you did talk about what's happening with the young children now in the schools and has been happening. But what about the influence of Arabic, since most of the speaking people speak Arabic, and you made a point of saying that at least those two were operating almost simultaneously in the household and probably in the shuk and so on.
I'm going to answer that question by reading a brief passage from the book, which is a quote from Wendy Sandler, the lead researcher, and she explains beautifully the answer. Wendy says, I had asked her, why is a village like this so exciting to a linguist? And this was her reply. A linguist never has the opportunity to see how language is born. All spoken languages are either thousands of years old or came about as a result of contact between languages that are thousands of years old. So in spoken language, there is no such thing. There can be no such thing as a new language born of nothing. Only in a sign language situation can that happen. If you get a deaf community, then a language will be born, and there are no other languages in the environment that are accessible. So I hope that answers your question about the influence of Arabic. Yes, most of the hearing people in the village are bilingual in spoken Arabic and the village sign language, but when the first deaf generation was born 70 years ago, what typically happens is deaf children spontaneously develop a system of signs for communicating with their hearing families. Linguists call these home signs. And because there were 10 deaf children born in one generation in close proximity, these pooled home signs very quickly developed spontaneously into a kind of signed pigeon. And in just one generation, when the children of those 10 deaf kids acquired this signed pigeon natively from the cradle, the language-making mechanism we're all born with kicked in, and this signed pigeon became what they call creolized. In other words, it was given more grammar, able to talk about more complex things, and in the space of one generation, just as happens with spoken language creoles, this pigeon had become a full language. Now, why is Arabic not an influence? Just as Wendy said, if you're a deaf person in this village, how would Arabic even intrude on your consciousness? Spoken language is not accessible. And that, in a nutshell, is why this village is so interesting, because here we have a sign language that in one generation has leapt from the grammar-making mechanism of the brain onto the hands with nothing to waylay it in between. So that's the long-winded answer.
Another question. Right here in the fifth row, hand up.
I had the pleasure of hearing Carol Padden, or rather watching Carol Padden speak a few years back about this same topic. And one fascinating piece of the culture that didn't come up tonight that I'd just like to add in is the startling thing to many deaf people in our culture, which is that deaf and deaf don't marry.
Right.
There.
All of the hearing,
and, yeah.
All of the hearing adults in this community are married. Most of them are married, and they're all married, as it happens, to hearing spouses. So again, within one family, you'll have a seamless integration of deaf and hearing. And as Carol Padden, the deaf scholar on the team, said, She has now been to the village probably a dozen times. She said to me, I have yet to walk into a room that's made up of only deaf people. That's how seamless the integration of deaf and hearing is in this village.
Right, and what she explained about the reason is that they said it would be very unfair for deaf people to marry deaf people because they want to make sure that if a deaf child is born to hearing parents, that they also have a deaf parent in that polygamous marriage. They also have a deaf mother or father present there in that marriage to help raise them.
Right.
So that and they'll have access in their family.
Because the particular type of deafness in the village is caused by a recessive gene, you do get cases where two hearing parents will have a deaf child. But thank goodness for polygamy, because it's very often the case that another wife in the same family compound will be deaf. So yet again, the deaf baby will get to acquire sign language natively from the cradle.
Another question on this side. Lady with her hand up.
Thank you. Is the number of children being born with deafness, is that going down or is it going up? I mean, statistically over the years now, is it like sort of the same or is it, you know, sort of remaining the same amount? And even though it's in the middle of nowhere, a Bedouin village, I mean, has there been any attempt to do any sort of genetic counseling or anything like that?
Oh, boy. To my knowledge, and I am not an expert by any means in the genetics of this community, to my knowledge, the rate of deaf births has been more or less constant for the three generations that deafness has existed in this village. However, as I discuss at the end of the book, certain Israeli geneticists are making inroads into the village and are trying to discourage the traditional practice of cousin marriage. And cousin marriage is a traditional way of consolidating land, of keeping land in the extended family. What the geneticists are now telling people in this traditional community is, no, no, no. If you don't stop marrying your cousins, your kids will all be deaf. Well, this didn't sit very well with Carol Patton, the deaf linguist on the team, as she said to me, what's the big deal? There's no trauma in being deaf in this community. The sign language is well underway. The deaf are included in everything. So as she says, it raises very deep anthropological questions about what it means to bring Western ideas of genetic counseling to a traditional community where those ideas may not be that relevant.
Time for a few more questions. Gentleman all the way in back on the left.
Thank you. You talked about the witnessing the creation of language, and I'm wondering if you know of any research that compares the research that's being done here to, I'm stretching to try and think of other examples. And one example I'm thinking of maybe is the way sometimes twin children will form a language between themselves to some extent. Or maybe I'm thinking of that Jodie Foster movie with, I think the character's name was Nell, where she's kind of raised in pretty much isolation, or her family is. And I think there are rare instances of that in the real world as well. So I'm wondering if any comparisons have been done. In some ways, those are also spontaneous creations of new languages.
Right. There is now a whole emerging subfield of linguistics called that has to do with language creation or language genesis. I'm not qualified to talk about that field as a whole. However, I can recommend a wonderful book on a related topic. There was a book that came out about 20 years ago by a medical anthropologist named Nora Grossi, G-R-O-C-E, called Everyone Here Spoke Sign Language.
It's published by Harvard, and it's about just such a community as a Syed, which, believe it or not, existed on Martha's Vineyard for about 250 years, from the 1700s to, about the end of the war in the last century. And for the same reasons, isolation, intermarriage, and the presence of a recessive gene for inherited deafness that proliferated in the community. And just as in a Syed, not only did the deaf people sign, but an overwhelming number of the hearing villagers did as well. Sadly, we have no record of what their indigenous sign language looked like. We do know it was very different from ASL, and it may have been rooted in British Sign Language because those Martha's Vineyard families came over as a group from the same region in England during the period when a lot of Puritans fled to the New World. Everyone here spoke sign language. It's the name of the book. It's a fascinating book. I recommend it highly.
Lady in the blue kerchief, and then we'll end up front here.
Hi, I'm interested in the linguistics and in if the four researchers are writing things, what their different focuses are. Like, I know you said that they're collecting the language, but are they also writing about syntax or the anthropology or just any more information?
These four linguists are very heavyweight theoretical linguists. So yes, in addition to doing more generally accessible things like producing a video dictionary, they are, for the last couple of years, they have been writing very heavyweight papers in scholarly journals, first looking at the morphology of the language, which means how words are built, in this case, how signs are built up from smaller component parts, and then looking at an even more minute level of structure, what in spoken language would be called phonology, and by analogy, it's called phonology even in soundless sign languages. So you can certainly do a search of the professional literature. If you search for Wendy Sandler, you would be able to pull up all their papers. And also Wendy, if you Google her name, you will pull up the website for her research lab, and she has an extensive bibliography on there.
And we'll land right here in the third row.
Thank you very much. Since sign languages are relatively new and not thousands of years old, was there ever a effort to make sign language a universal language? So there wouldn't be a German version and a French one and a Swedish one and a...
To my knowledge, there was no effort, certainly nothing concerted and organized, because it simply would not be possible, just as no real effort to make a universal spoken language would be possible. Even within this, languages automatically diversify. That's just what human languages do. And one of the really interesting things about sign language is they too, like spoken languages, have regional and ethnic dialects. So even within this country, there isn't any one rigid ASL. It's a fluid, living, breathing thing that changes both over geography and historically over time.
Thank you very much. We will continue the conversation upstairs. Please thank Margalit Fox and Yona Diamond-Dansky.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.